And that's where we are going to pick up with Ezra. Ezra represents the first phase of the return of the nation of Israel from captivity in Babylon back to Jerusalem. And it's not just one trip. You know, it represents a series of phases in, over a course of years and a number of personalities. And after a number of phases, this return from Babylon to Israel pretty much finishes up. And Ezra and Nehemiah really record those phases of repatriation of these folks that had been taken captive into Babylon, leaving Babylon and going back to Israel. And what do they do in Israel? Well, first thing they do when they get back to Israel is they rebuild the temple. And that's a very important role for them to undertake because, you know, if you want to follow the law, you can't do it without a temple. No way you can follow the law without a temple. So that's what their very first course of action was to do. We've got to get this temple rebuilt. So they get the temple rebuilt, and that's the temple that ultimately is the same temple that Jesus walks around in the Gospels.
Hmm. Now, Chris, hold on. That first temple, Solomon had, was super wealthy, beyond compared even to today. And that's how this was funded. So how did these ex-slaves come up with enough money to duplicate that?
It's a great question. And it's a great question. We're going to see miraculously in Ezra kind of how that happens.
Okay.
It's miraculous. It's really crazy. But yeah, it's not, and the second temple doesn't have the same grandeur as the first temple. Okay. And by the way, sometimes you'll hear, we're going to talk about a guy named Zerubbabel. And Zerubbabel is really the person that's described in Ezra that leads the effort to build the second temple. Sometimes you'll hear this temple that Jesus spends time in is Herod's temple. It's actually Zerubbabel's temple. But Zerubbabel is the one that sponsored the activity, led it, got it going, and you'll see some of the miraculous events that got it established. And later on in history, Herod was a, when he became, again, Herod was not Jewish by ethnicity, but he became the king of the Jews. And Herod, around the time of birth of Christ, was really known for being a grandiose builder. He undertook a lot of building projects. And one of the building projects he undertook was a remodeling of Zerubbabel's temple. So that's why often it's called Herod's temple, because he took that second temple and he just added to its magnificence.
It's easier to say.
Yeah.
Even though he couldn't go inside of it?
Who, Herod? Or?
Yeah.
He probably... And I don't know if he ever really, he may have kind of went in the outer court, but it's a good question. I'm not sure what exactly.
It's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, and that period of Israel kind of getting back to the land, one of the things, and the reason these two books set up the New Testament is because of the fact that one of the purposes or one of the thoughts that was prevalent among Israel as they returned to the land was a reflection on why did this disaster happen to us in the first place? And how can we prevent it from happening again? And that was a very important question to ask and answer, because you don't want to spend, it's hard enough to build, let alone to get destroyed, taken captive, and have to return and rebuild. It's just a painful, horrifically costly process. And so the question became, how do we stop this from happening again? And as these folks in Israel really looked at this question, they realized that, you know what, the answer was here the whole time in Torah. It was here in the law the whole time. God told us, Yahweh told us that he loves us, he'll take care of us. But if we break his law, if we go in our own way, if we forsake him and follow idols, then we're going to pay the ultimate price, which is going to be disconnection from the land we were promised. And so, being back in the land, Israel had the sense that we have got to prevent this disaster from ever happening again. And so set up the process of what we find in the New Testament, this classification or these party structures in Israel of Pharisees and Sadducees and synagogues and scribes and lawyers, a whole cadre of people meant to ensure we got to know the law. And not only do we have to know the law, we got to make sure everyone else knows the law, and we can't break it. Because if we break the law, we're going to end up like we did with Babylon. And that is the origin of rabbinic Judaism. That the Pharisees arise out of that milieu, and after Jesus, the Pharisees transform into the rabbis. And the intent, and this is where also you get what Jesus speaks of a lot in the Gospels, the traditions of men. The intention of these folks in Israel, these leaders, the lawyers and the scribes, and what became known as the Pharisees, was we've got to make sure no one breaks the law. And so with good intent, but with a bad outcome, they said, what's a way we can make sure people don't break the law? Let's create additional rules to kind of surround the law so that if people break these additional rules, at least they wouldn't have maybe busted through and broken the law. So the idea was to create these traditions of men that had a good intention to create boundaries, man-made boundaries of rules and regulations that would even prevent people from possibly breaking the law. Again, the goal was let's not have cataclysm happen to us again. And that begins this process of this whole framework of rules and regulations that Jesus calls traditions of men. That turn out to be a perversion of the law in many ways. Again, started with good intention, but ended up to be a disaster. So, again, these two books, Ezra and Nehemiah, are going to show us the origin of that time period and this return from Babylon. What I want to do now is actually step back and look at where this process fits, like in the entire scope of, you know, the Bible and world history. So, you know, when you read our Bible, you see Genesis, and you got Adam, and you have Abraham come along, and then eventually you get to Moses, and Moses is in Egypt. And so Moses is at a time period where Egypt is a world, probably the dominant world empire. And that's around, say, 1400 BC, about 1400 years before Jesus was born. And so it's in Egypt that Israel is formed as a nation, in kind of like in Babylon. It's a form of a nation forming in captivity. They're slaves in Egypt. And through Moses, around that time period, they're led out of Egypt. They receive the Mosaic Law in Sinai, the 613 commandments, and they end up back in the land. And so from Egypt, as a world empire, you've got Israel going back to the land, leaving captivity, and you end up with the first monarchy in Israel. Israel becomes a monarchy under the first king of Israel. Anyone know who that is?
Saul.
Saul, that's right, yeah, King Saul. And this whole process between Egypt and Saul, this is probably let's call this 1100 BC. Probably after that even. Is you got Exodus, and then you've got Joshua and Judges in this period. And you get to Saul, and that's 1 Kings. And from Saul, you go to David, which is about 1000 BC. And from David, you get to Solomon, which is about 930 BC. And so you have three generations of a monarchy in Israel. And in this period of time is the apex, the height of Israel's glory as a nation. It's an empire. And it actually
overshadows Egypt. And so at this period of time, brief as it is, Israel is probably the leading world empire on earth. And after Solomon, what happens is you get civil war in Israel. Israel breaks up, kind of like our nation did, into north and south. And from after Solomon, you have these 10 tribes saying to the Solomon's son, we're leaving, we don't like you, we don't want anything to do with you. And so you have what begins the Northern Kingdom, which is all of Israel except for two tribes. Judah, which is David's tribe, that's where the Davidic royal line comes from, and Benjamin. So the southern tribe often, or the southern kingdom is often known as Judah in our Bibles, or your historians, and the northern kingdom is often called Israel. It's the 10 tribes. And the problem develops when Israel divides like that, because the true worship that's obedient to Torah is really only occurring in the southern kingdom, Judah, because that's where Jerusalem is and that's where the temple is. As part of trying to separate from the southern kingdom, the northern kingdom, in disobedience, says, well, we're going to set up the exact same system where we live. So they set up kind of a similar temple on a different mountain with the same rules, trying to recreate what God had given through the Mosaic Law. And they do it in the capital of the northern kingdom, Samaria. So we're going to find out, too, we're going to talk a lot about Samaria and how Samaria, that's why it plays so large in the Gospels, because it was part of a rebellious part of the nation. And they set up, instead of a temple on Mount Zion in Jerusalem, on Mount Gerizim in Samaria. So you've got a whole separate, in a disobedience to the law, the separate religious system occurring. And ultimately what happens is, after the Civil War occurs, Israel starts to go on the major decline as an empire. And in between, and after that, there's the ascent of a new empire comes on the scene, known as Assyria. So as Israel, Northern Kingdom, Southern Kingdom, are deteriorating and losing all of, think of the British Empire after World War II, just completely collapsing, or maybe America now. You've got Israel just completely collapsing, and a new world power filling that vacuum. It's Assyria. It's basically this giant empire that begins where Turkey is now and expands over, where Turkey is, Iraq, Iran. And Assyria begins to look southward to expand and sees south of it, the northern kingdom. And eventually, Assyria devours the northern kingdom. In 721 BC, after a series of invasions, Assyria lifts out this capital, all of the leadership in this capital, Samaria, of this infrastructure of government in Samaria, and takes them out of Samaria into places like Turkey and even Greece. And this is where you start this beginning of this concept known as diaspora, Jewish communities being exiled from the land and forming in these other communities where Paul goes to preach eventually 800 years later in synagogues. And Assyria is part of this campaign of just getting people out of the land. Now, they don't take every single Jew into the northern kingdom. That would be logistically impossible. But they take the leadership. And not only that, they install their puppet governments by taking folks from all different areas of their empire and bringing them into Samaria and planting them, saying, you guys are the new rulers. So this is the first disaster in the Bible that befalls Israel. This is recorded in Kings. And it's also predicted by Isaiah. There's a lot of prophets that the Lord sends to the north and to the south to say, look, you guys got to turn this thing around or you're going to face some serious consequences. Just 1 second.
Okay.
And so despite all of the warnings, the northern kingdom continues to thumb its nose and it's eventually gone. And all then you have left is this place called the southern kingdom.
Oh, okay.
Which is Jerusalem, which is Judah and Benjamin in Jerusalem. And after the northern kingdom disappears, they're freaked out, like, we're next. I'm sorry, Lou, did you have a question?
Just answer.
Okay.
No buffer zone.
So that's exactly right. And the southern, and Isaiah has been telling the southern kingdom, you've got to make this right. You've got to get this figured out. And the southern kingdom continues to rebel against the Lord. Well, eventually, the Assyria almost takes Jerusalem down. And miraculously, 100,000 Assyrian troops die from the plague as they're at the gates of Jerusalem, and they end up leaving. And the southern kingdom is actually survives, and Assyria starts to deteriorate as a world power.
Why? What happened for God to destroy by the plague the Assyrian? What happened?
Keeping the nation of Israel alive. Saving his chosen people. It's basically the best quick explanation.
In spite of them.
In spite of himself. So, the southern kingdom survives, but a new empire emerges to take over Assyria, known as Babylon. And this is, let's say, 680 BC. So all of this northern area where Assyria had really conquered in the northern kingdom of Israel, been conquered by Assyria, out of Iraq arises a guy in a series of kings that end up in Nebuchadnezzar that say to the Syrians, we want your empire. And so the Babylonians, instead of being centered in Turkey, this is Iraq, they move eastward into Turkey, and they start to take over the Syrian Empire, and it becomes Babylon, the Babylonian Empire. And the southern kingdom is still just this little outpost, and they begin to get threatened by this new Babylonian Empire. And the southern kingdom starts to get really freaked out. And God, after Isaiah, about 150 years later, God raises up a new prophet, Jeremiah. And Jeremiah, just like Isaiah was warning the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom about Assyria, Jeremiah is raised up by Yahweh to warn the southern kingdom about Babylon. You better get right. You gotta fix everything that's wrong. And eventually, Jeremiah hears from the Lord, you know what? We're done. This nation of Israel is going to be punished or disciplined for breaking all of our statutes and going to go into captivity. So Yahweh actually reveals to Jeremiah the nation is going to be taken over by Nebuchadnezzar. And so when Jeremiah takes that prophecy to the kings and the prophets in Jerusalem, how do you think Jeremiah is received?
Not well.
You're a traitor. We're going to kill you. Yeah, Jeremiah's a great example of, man, you could be just you and God and against the entire world. And it's a very scary experience for Jeremiah.
The northern kingdom never gets back in at the time of the...
Yeah, and just a few thoughts. One is, not only the northern kingdom never becomes a political entity again, but even though the aristocracy is transferred, there's still a lot of Jews from the tribes that are living there, and they're intermarrying with these new folks that get supplanted in. And they eventually become this ethnic group known as the Samaritans later, which by the time Jesus arrives, the Jews in Jerusalem say, man, they're half-breeds. We can't really trust them. But yeah, even though the northern kingdom disappears as a political entity, there's still a lot of the ethnic Jews from the northern kingdom still up in there, but most of the leadership's been pulled out. So eventually, what happens is the big catastrophe for the northern kingdom is 721. In 586, this is the next big catastrophe in world history, and in your Bible you should know this date, because that's when Nebuchadnezzar... Now, Nebuchadnezzar begins invading the southern kingdom around 605 B.C., and he tries to get Jerusalem to, like, stop, you know, getting uppity. And, but they keep on kind of, you know, giving the middle finger to Babylon foolishly. And finally, Nebuchadnezzar in 586 says, that's it, we've had enough. They go in there and they level the temple. And they take the last kind of contingent of governance out of Jerusalem into Babylon. And thus, in 586, you get, you know, the southern kingdom, Israel as a political entity, ceasing to exist.
Wow.
So with that, oh, and then just really quickly, you get this captivity, and we'll talk about the length of the captivity in Babylon. The nation of Israel in captivity in Babylon returns, which is what we're going to read about in Ezra and Nehemiah. And then eventually, in, let's call it, and the reason you're going to see, we're going to see that Israel is allowed to return to the land is because there's even another empire that takes over Babylon called the Persian Empire. And the Persians are basically Iranians, modern-day Iran. So, you know, the Babylon's representing what we would think of as Iraq now, taking over Assyrian, which would be Turkey. Now you got the Iranians, what we see now is Iran. The Persians saying, now we're taking over the whole deal. And the Persians rise up and take over the Babylonian Empire. And there's this guy named Cyrus who we're going to read about, a Persian king that says, Israel, guess what? You can go back to your land and build your temple. It's crazy. It's miraculous. Persian Empire is the next world empire. And the Persian Empire is ultimately taken down by a guy named Alexander the Great. 323 BC, Alexander the Great, this dude in northern Greece says, I'm going to take over the world. And he does. In less than 20 years, Alexander the Great takes over the known world. I mean, from Europe to China.
And he's pro-Christian.
Well, Jesus wasn't born yet. He was Greek, yes. So that's where Hellenism, this is where Greek culture really takes over in Europe and the Middle East. And then ultimately, when Jesus comes on the scene, the Roman Empire starts to take over the Grecian Empire. And... you know, the Roman Empire is the next world empire on the scene at that point in time when Jesus is born. So let's take a look at let's take a look at Ezra chapter 1.
Chris, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, please, go ahead.
I was told one time that Israel never really has to worry about being completely taken over today because God won't let that happen because it's his chosen people. But from what you just went through, God let it happen.
Right, yeah, right. And I'm not sure I would say the same thing. Because Israel's back in the land, that's right. And I probably don't believe they're going to end up out of the land again. But I want, you know, we can't, it's kind of like predicting, oh, Jesus is going to return on this day. You know, he's the control of the future. We know the prophecies, we know what to expect, kind of, but it's exactly right. The reason that Jeremiah was the reason, even though Jeremiah was sent by God to tell these guys to submit to Babylon, these guys were going to kill Jeremiah because they thought, we're the chosen people. God will never let this temple go down. And he did. And we're going to find out why in just a second here.
Just real quick, I don't want to take you off track. But Jesus hadn't come. The temple's removed. I think God's like, okay, I'm going to take you to the next level. You don't need that building. You can be with me. But Jesus hadn't come yet. So what happens to these people who all of their lives for generations have said, we got to go to here. We got to be in this building. We got to do all these things to be Jewish. And it's gone. What do?
They freak out. You mean when they go into Babylon?
Well, when it's leveled and it's gone, but they're still Jewish.
They totally.
In their culture.
So great point.
What do they do?
They develop.
I would think a lot of people would have become lost and put
they
it aside,
did.
And their children would disavow.
They
now
did.
Christmas all of a sudden.
The children don't disavow. What they do is they form something to kind of bridge the gap. They form something that we know as the synagogue.
Synagogue did not exist until the Babylonian captivity. But no temple. What do we do?
Okay.
You form a little building, kind of what we would call a church. You get guys to get together, start reading the Mosaic Law. What do we do? And so that's what the whole rabbinic law is based on. How do we function with the law without a temple? That's exactly right. Okay, so let's take a look at Ezra chapter 1. And, man, there's a lot here, but let's take a look at four verses, the first four verses, and we'll talk a little bit about this, and then we'll end.
Right.
Could someone read verses 1 through 4
in
Ezra chapter 1?
Now, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it in writing, saying, "Thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all his people, may his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem. Every survivor, at whatever place he may live, let the men of that place support him with silver and gold, with goods and cattle, together with a freewill offering for the house of God, which is in Jerusalem."
Okay, good. Thanks, Lou. So this sets out, Ezra, and this sets out this time period that we're going to call the return from Babylon. The whole theme of our study, the return from Babylon. This is the beginning. And what's really cool about the Bible is that we can date the beginning of this return. What's the date of the beginning of this return? Verse
beginning
1.
Beginning of Cyrus's
time. Yeah, we know that this happens on the date of the first year of King Cyrus of Persia. Now, Persia, again, they take over the Babylonians, and that happens, and that's recorded in Daniel chapter 8. The destruction of the Babylonian Empire and the conquest by the Persians is recorded in Daniel chapter 8, because Daniel is one of these guys that's in Babylon, because he got taken captive by the Babylonians when he was a 16-year-old boy. So Daniel records that destruction of Babylon by the Persians in chapter 8. That happens in 539 B.C. And so, even though Cyrus had been the king of kind of the kingdom of Persia for a number of years, once he takes over Babylon and becomes emperor of and the Persian Empire supersedes the Babylonian Empire, this is what is known as the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia. This is actually 538 BC, roughly, scholars tell us. So, 538 BC, the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, he issues this proclamation. The end of verse 1. Sent a proclamation throughout the Persian Empire, and he puts it in writing, which is a big deal for the ancients. And what's this proclamation say, basically, if anyone wants to give an interpretation of verses 1 through 4? What's the content of this proclamation?
Basically opening up and putting everything in Jerusalem.
Yeah. You guys in captivity, go back.
Yeah. You can go back.
You don't have to stay here anymore. Go back and rebuild your temple. Become a nation again.
That was pretty cool.
That is really cool. Why did Cyrus do that? Verse 1.
Because of Jeremiah.
That to fulfill the word. Because this is what God predicted. That's exactly right. Check it out. Cyrus issued this proclamation, verse 1, to fulfill the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah. That's exactly right. So what do you think Jeremiah said? Anyone have any ideas as to what Jeremiah was even talking about? That the Lord fulfills this prophecy. We'll talk about it next Friday. Far from there.
Cool. Joe, what's your